The Brain Drain by Ayn Rand.
The subject of today's discussion is the brain drain. The collapse of England is in the headlines and on the front pages of the world today. In the screaming chorus of the superficial, concrete-bound commentaries on the causes of that collapse, few people have noticed a recent news item which was much less spectacular and much more significant than the devaluation of the pound. That news item gave the fundamental cause of England's collapse, but apparently no one identified its significance. It appeared in the New York Times on October 11, 1967, under the heading British Sea Peril in Brain Drain. The item went as follows, quote, "The growing brain drain of young scientists and engineers is threatening disastrous consequences in Britain," a special committee reported to the government today. The report, entitled Brain Drain, said that 2 of every 5 engineers were emigrating soon after attaining accredited status. The migration to North America has quadrupled in the last 6 years. Only after 10 or 20 years will the full impact of the loss be apparent, the report said. It described the young emigrants as the seed corn of our future prosperity. To reverse the flow, the committee urged more challenging jobs for technicians in industry, higher pay as a deliberate national policy for the exceptionally talented, government financial incentives, and a better national appreciation of the role of the industrial scientist and engineer. And further, Anthony Wedgwood, then Minister of Technology, said in commenting on the report that the pull of the United States was a major factor in the brain drain. The committee found that wages in the United States, often 3 times as high as in Britain, were only part of the reason for the drain. I want to stress and repeat this. The wages were only part of the reason for the drain. Other attractions were such massive technical programs as space, oceanography, and weaponry, and the higher status enjoyed by the scientists in American society. The report showed that emigration had almost doubled from about 3,200 in 1961, consisting of 1,900 engineers and 1,300 scientists, to 6,200 in 1966, with 4,200 engineers and 2,000 scientists. The immigrants were mostly in their late 20s, the report showed, and mostly recent university graduates. Last year, 42% of the new engineers and 23% of the new scientists were said to have left the country. The committee called for more positive policies, such as increased seats in the boardroom for scientists and engineers, an easing of taxes on manufacturers to permit higher salaries, and a yearly review of the government's research and development programs. It also urged closer integration of university science and engineering departments, a better public relations program for British industry, and the fostering of hero worship of technical men. Close quote. I want to repeat this to make it very clear what is the actual meaning of this news item. Here is a socialist government which is advocating higher pay as a deliberate national policy for whom? For the exceptionally talented. It is advocating an easing of taxes on manufacturers to permit higher salaries For whom? For the exceptionally talented. And, of all things, a better public relations program for British industry and the fostering of hero worship of technical men. Those who have read my novel, Atlas Shrugged, will understand why I personally would take this news item as very grimly ironic. A socialist government is asking for the hero worship of technical men. What kind of technical men? Of the exceptionally talented. A socialist government is declaring that the exceptionally talented are the seed corn of their future prosperity. There is only one inaccuracy, it's philosophically, in this report on the British brain drain. It is the idea that England will feel the full impact of the loss of her talent 10 or 20 years in the future. The full impact is being felt right now. It is significant to observe what name the British have given to the phenomenon of the talented, the ambitious, the best men of England leaving her, the brain drain. To that extent, people apparently are aware of the real nature of the phenomenon. It is the brains that are leaving England and have been leaving for some time, and at present the exodus is accelerating year by year. It is not merely a drain, it is now a stampede. To the extent to which a man has brains, has talent, has productive ability, to that extent he is eager to escape from the welfare state slave pen which England has become. This is why England is collapsing. To grasp the full meaning of this report on the brain drain, one must ask and answer two questions. What is the actual social meaning of industry? And for what attribute should one hero worship the technical men? The answer to both questions is the same and can be conveyed in a single word. Intelligence. Or, more specifically, it is contained in a single issue, the role of man's mind in human existence. In my article on What is Capitalism in 1965, I wrote as follows. Quote, while altruism seeks to rob intelligence of its rewards, by asserting that the moral duty of the competent is to serve the incompetent and sacrifice themselves to anyone's need, the tribal premise, that is collectivism, goes a step further. It denies the existence of intelligence and of its role in the production of wealth. It is morally obscene to regard wealth as an anonymous tribal product and to talk about redistributing it. The view that wealth is the result of some undifferentiated collective process, that we all did something and it's impossible to tell who did what, therefore some sort of equalitarian distribution is necessary, might have been appropriate in a primordial jungle with a savage horde moving boulders by crude physical labor. Though even there, someone had to initiate and organize the moving. To hold that view in an industrial society where individual achievements are a matter of public record is so crass an evasion that even to give it the benefit of the doubt is an obscenity. Anyone who has ever been an employer or an employee, or has observed men working, or has done an honest day's work himself, knows the crucial role of ability, of intelligence, of a focused, competent mind in any and all lines of work, from the lowest to the highest. He knows that ability, or the lack of it, whether the lack is actual or volitional, makes a difference of life or death in any productive process. The evidence is so overwhelming, theoretically and practically, logically and empirically, in the events of history and in anyone's own daily grind, that no one can claim ignorance of it. Mistakes of this size are not made innocently. Observe how seldom and how inadequately the issue of human intelligence is discussed in the writings of the collectivist, statist, altruist theoreticians. Observe how carefully today's advocates of a mixed economy avoid and evade any mention of intelligence or ability in their approach to political-economic issues, in their claims, demands, and pressure group warfare over the looting of the total social product. Close quote. The issue which has to be grasped here, the issue at the root of all politics, of all social systems, and of their rise, prosperity, or collapse, is the fundamental fact of man's nature, the fact that man's mind is his basic means of survival, his only means of gaining knowledge. In order to sustain its life, every living species has to follow a certain course of action required by its nature. The action required to sustain human life is primarily intellectual. Everything man needs has to be discovered by his mind and produced by his effort. Production is the application of reason to the problem of survival. If some men do not choose to think, they can survive only by imitating and repeating a routine of work discovered by others, but those others had to discover it, or none would have survived. If some men do not choose to think or to work, they can survive, temporarily, only by looting the goods produced by others, but those others had to produce them, or none would have survived. Regardless of what choice is made in this issue by any man or by any number of men, regardless of what blind, irrational, or evil course they may choose to pursue, the fact remains that reason is man's means of survival and that men prosper or fail, survive or perish in proportion to the degree of their rationality. Since knowledge, thinking and rational action are properties of the individual, since the choice to exercise his rational faculty or not depends on the individual, man's survival requires that those who think be free of the interference of those who don't. Since men are neither omniscient nor infallible, they must be free to agree or disagree, to cooperate or to pursue their own independent course, each according to his own rational judgment. Freedom is the fundamental requirement of man's mind. A rational mind does not work under compulsion. It does not subordinate its grasp of reality to anyone's orders, directives, or controls. It does not sacrifice its knowledge, its view of the truth, to anyone's opinions, threats, wishes, plans, or welfare. Such a mind may be hampered by others. It may be silenced, proscribed, imprisoned, or destroyed. It cannot be forced. A gun is not an argument. It is from the work and the inviolate integrity of such minds, from the intransigent innovators, that all of mankind's knowledge and achievements have come. For details, see the Fountainhead. It is to such minds that mankind owes its survival. For details, see Atlas Shrugged. The same principle applies to all men on every level of ability and ambition. To the extent that a man is guided by his rational judgment, he acts in accordance with the requirements of his nature, and, to that extent, succeeds in achieving a human form of survival and well-being. To the extent that he acts irrationally, he acts as his own destroyer. The social recognition of man's rational nature, of the connection between his survival and his use of reason, is the concept of individual rights. But this is the issue which collectivism cannot acknowledge. All the theories of collectivism are made possible only by the evasion of this issue. Every practical variant of collectivism, every status social system, whether it is communism, Nazism, socialism, fascism, or the welfare state, all of them can exist only so long as their leaders and their victims continue to ignore the issue of man's mind and of the fact that man's mind requires freedom. It is not necessary to experiment forever, to spend centuries destroying generations of men. It is not necessary to experiment once one understands the fact that man is a rational being, that he requires reason in order to exist, the corollary, the necessary consequence, follows. If man has to survive by means of reason, by means of the use of his mind, then freedom is the basic requirement of his survival and prosperity. He can survive, he can think, only to the extent that he is free, to the extent to which controls are imposed on him, to the extent to which he is not left free to function, to that extent he, the man, and the whole society in which he functions go down, and ultimately, if the trend is not reversed, they collapse. This is the explanation, the real fundamental reason of England's collapse. England is ahead of the United States in its descent to collectivism, but we are not far behind. On the example of England, the whole civilized world, or what is left of it today, can observe in practice the nature of collectivism, of a peaceful collectivism, achieved by vote, not by force, achieved by suicide, not by murder. One can observe the nature of collectivism and convince oneself by a practical example of why no form of collectivism, no form of statism can ever lead mankind to anything but destruction and collapse. And if peace, prosperity, welfare, actual welfare, the welfare of every individual man, are any thinker's goal, then in the name of concern for mankind, if not in a higher name, the higher name being concern for justice. Men should advocate capitalism, not collectivism, as the only system which can achieve every socially desirable and defensible goal that anyone has ever advanced. Capitalism is the only system compatible with man's rational nature. Now, the belief that the mind can work under orders is the cause of the popularity of collectivism. In fact, collectivism is long since dead intellectually, but by default of an alternative, mankind is still moving in the direction of collectivism, and the reason that the average man accepts it, even if suspiciously and reluctantly, is that most people, the intellectual leaders, as well as the average man, do not understand the nature of man's mind, nor the conditions that the mind requires to function. People believe, in effect, naively, that scientific progress, industrial progress, are a matter of agreement among men, that the truth is obvious, almost in effect self-evident, and that all that men need in order to agree on the right course is goodwill. This, of course, is the greatest of fallacies. It is not that an intelligent man does not want to work for the state, for the collective, or for others. Of course, he does not want it, to the extent that he is honest and intelligent, he will not accept a slavery of that kind. But assume for the moment that by delusion, by being taken in by the altruist morality, such a man accepted the goal of working for others, of serving the state. Assume that he wanted to serve the state. The fact is that it would not be possible. It is not a matter of human motives. It is not a matter of naive, good or evil, naive and perverted at the same time, which is presented by altruism. The fact is that in order to provide knowledge, to seek and to gain knowledge, an individual mind has to be free to function. And fundamentally, he must be free to function alone. All thinking is done by individual minds. It cannot be done collectively. Man can cooperate only on the basis of such thinking as they have already done, of such knowledge as they have already acquired. But to go further, to pursue new knowledge, to achieve theoretical, scientific, and therefore later practical technological progress, men have to do their thinking alone. If they cooperate on any given project, it is still true that each has to be free to agree with his colleagues or to disagree. With the best, in quotes, altruistic intentions in the world, a man of talent, that is a man of intelligence and productive ability, would not be able to work with a committee. The most intelligent and honest man in the world would not necessarily agree on the projection of a new hypothesis, the pursuit of a new theory. It is not an issue of immorality or ill will. In looking, in searching for the new, men of goodwill and intelligence can and do disagree. It is in this matter that the whole issue of human freedom lies, not in the issue of motives or intentions, good or bad, but in the fact that a mind has to work alone, at least fundamentally, in his thinking, in his basic pursuit of knowledge, and can properly or productively cooperate with others only later, only on the basis of the knowledge already acquired. It is that basic freedom to think that collectivism kills and stops. And, of course, though that is not the center of my subject today, it is also true that altruism is a monstrous immorality, that it is an evil system presented in the guise of morality and accepted by men unthinkingly, not really accepted, just given lip service. And it is true that no man of intelligence and integrity can accept altruism, can accept the idea that he must be the selfless, self-sacrificial servant of the state or of society or of the government. A man of self-esteem and of intelligence cannot accept it. The trouble today is only that he will regard himself as guilty for not being able to accept it. But guilty or not, he will not function under compulsion, and that is why he will run from any collectivist state by any means, more often than not at the price of his life. Just as men perished, thousands, uncounted thousands of men perished trying to escape from Soviet Russia or from Nazi Germany concentration camps, so today, men are running from the welfare state of England, running to Canada, to the United States, to any country where a comparative, only comparative, degree of freedom still exists. But unless we learn from the example of England's collapse, that comparative degree of freedom will not remain in existence much longer. Unless men begin to grasp that freedom is not a luxury nor an allegedly selfish whim of the talented, unless men grasp that freedom is a necessity of human survival, and that without the talented man, the less talented have no way to survive, unless we grasp it and work for the renaissance of that principle here in the United States, the rest of the world will perish and we will be on our way into another dark ages. I do not believe that this will be necessary. The United States still has a chance.
For additional information about other available programs, please contact Second Renaissance at 1-800-729-6149 or at www.ayanrandbookstore.com. All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before an audience, without the express written permission of the producer, Second Renaissance Incorporated.